Blog Talk Radio.
It will make a weak man mighty. It will make a mighty man. We'll fill your heart, man, or leave you with nothing at all. It's the eyes for the blind, the legs for the lame. It is the love for hate that rides. That's the power of the gospel. That's the power of the mighty, mighty power. That's the power of the gospel. That's the power of the gospel on the water. Gospel on the land. The gospel is gospel in every man. Gospel.
the gospel when you start out on your way. Now that's the power of the gospel. That's the power of the gospel. That's the power of the life, the power. That's the power of the gospel.
Welcome to African Aramean Script. Host, Brother Charles. Introduction to Biblical Aramaic. First, at length discourse on the history of brief history, brief presentation of Biblical Aramaic, Aryan textual biblical traditions. And we decided to make this presentation as a follow-up to the previous podcast on Abraham the Aramean. And that was done to set the foundation for our overstanding that Aramaic was the fountainhead of culture and language from which, upon combination with Canaanite, gave rise to what we know as the Hebrew language and culture. Hebrew language and culture was based in Aramaic and Canaanite cultures, and it's the byproduct, the child, if you will, of the two. However, Aramaic has been taking a back seat to Hebrew, and little is being studied of Canaanite, which we will do presentations on Canaanite in the future. But right now, we intend to explore, survey the history briefly of Aramaic in biblical text. Now, one of the earliest things we learn about biblical Aramaic is that it was used as a language amongst ancient Israelites before the Babylonian and Persian exile in 586 BC. However, it wasn't dominant, and the script known as Canaanite, which was and that script was also an old Phoenician or Paleo Hebrew. That script was the script being used at the time, and Aramaic was also written with the same script as Canaanite at all areas. However, the script that was used to write Biblical Hebrew upon the return of the Judeans from the Babylonian captivity, the square script was used, because the square script had been invented at that time to designate the same characters of the previous era, the Paleo, the old Canaanite characters. Now, that's the major shift in writing that that has to be noted. Okay, now just a brief little mention here of some of the texts that are written in Aramaic that will be extremely helpful in your learning what's the application You know, why learn Aramaic? What am I going to be able to read as a result of learning it? Well, if you intend on doing your reading the source text yourself, which hopefully be able to teach and make your own translations where the passages may be troublesome in the English, they don't make sense or something, you have questions, you can be able to investigate them yourself. Go in and do the work. Now, in the Old Testament, Biblical Aramaic is found in five passages of the Masoretic text. Now, the Masoretic text is a traditional Pharisaic edition of the Old Testament, a rabbinic text. However, these five places were traditional Aramaic before the establishment of the Masoretic tradition, and they remain so after the Masoretic tradition had become dominant, or established rather. Now, in the Old Testament, Aramaic is found in five passages. Here it is: Genesis 31:47, Jeremiah 10:11, Ezra 4:8 through the chapter 6:18, and picking up again in chapter 7:12-26, and all the rest of the passages in the book of Ezra are all Hebrew. And in Daniel 2:4b begins the Aramaic section through to chapter 7, concluding at verse 28. Now, that's what you would read if you were, you decide you want to study Biblical Hebrew and you got to study it. You would run into these Aramaic passages, and then you would see the necessity to learn Aramaic in order to be able to read them. That's what you'd have to do. So learning Aramaic is a part of the curriculum of becoming literate in Israelite literature. No way around it. It's something you should do. And, okay, now we can get the name of the Aramaic language. It's derived from the Hebrew word Aramit, and it can be found in Ezra 4:7 and in Daniel 2:4a. And another term that is also used in Daniel for Aramaic is Targum. I can't tell you exactly where that would be found. I just remember seeing it some places, but the Targum is an Old Testament paraphrase, rabbinic paraphrase on the Old Testament. By paraphrase, we mean it's not a direct translation from a more ancient Hebrew text. It does come from a more ancient Hebrew text that's non-Masoretic. The person who made the paraphrase was basically giving his interpretive reading of the Hebrew passages as he and people part of his school thought was appropriate. So it was publicly read in synagogues during the Second Temple period. When we say Second Temple period, that's the period following the Babylonian exile, a period upon the return of Judeans from Babylon and Persia. Okay, now, Onkelos is the first guy who's accredited for making Aramaic paraphrase. He's surnamed, he's also called the Hagar, and Ger means a foreigner or sojourner. And that Ha is a definite article, so it means the foreigner, the alien. And he's a proselyte, he's probably descended from some nationals that, origins, nationality unknown, and he had embraced Judaism, ancient Judaism, of the Pharisaic flavor. And he had lived long before the rabbinic schools came into existence. So that means exactly what it says. Before the schools came up, Onkelos was already on the scene. I said, through the precise time cannot be ascertained with certainty. Most probably thought that he flourished at the time of the return from the Babylonian captivity, when the Judeans had lost, the common people had lost the knowledge of the Hebrew language as the first language. Okay? So this was Onkelos person. He translated the Tanakh, or the Old Testament, the five books of Moses, into Chaldee, and Chaldee is another synonym for Aramaic, and paraphrased certain passages. This paraphrase or translation is called the Targum. Okay, the paraphrase on the Humash, it's also another name for Humash means five, and that's also another word for the books of Moses. And he had in the ancient Judean church, and it had the same authority as the Hebrew text. Now this, that means they used it for public reading, and they sourced it, and it was considered sacred. And it was always read in the synagogue after the Hebrew had been read. So its place wasn't considered more lofty than the Hebrew text, but it was considered to be something that people would read, handle, and the Hebrew was understood to be the pure ancient tradition of the nation. Now, there's another paraphrase called Targum Yerushalayim, all right, or Yerushalami. So it's a Targum. So it's a Jerusalem Targum, and it's said to have been written by a person by the name of Yehonatan ben Uziel, and it contains only very short paraphrastic notes, and not all the verses, but is of great value, having preserved faithfully and without corruption the faith of the current people, the people who kept it. Basically what it's saying is that they didn't alter the paraphrase, so it's been kept in a consistent condition as it was believed to have been in originality. So that, and so there's, and so there are quite a few paraphrase under the name of Jerusalem, Jerusalem Targum. So you got the Onkelos, and you had sometimes they call it Targum Jonathan. So you may see it written as Targum Jerusalem or Yerushalami, Targum Jonathan, same thing. And Onkelos is different. Okay. These are the Old Testament Aramaic copies of the Bible. Now, we'll go on to look at how important it, and how was this shift done to start really making a lot of copies. As we will get into that briefly, we'll also look at a few other important documents that have been in continuous usage. Some have been located in the last century. The Dead Sea Scrolls, located in the middle of the 20th century. And it had over 40,000 fragments, containing 500 scrolls dating back to 250 BCE. And the scrolls, of course, were primarily written in Hebrew and Aramaic. There were some Greek texts among them, but most of them were of Hebrew and Aramaic of composition. Now, there are a few other documents. There was one called the Letter of Gamaliel. And Gamaliel was the famous, Gamaliel the First was the famous teacher of Rav Shaul, or the Apostle Paul. And he's cited much in the Mishnah. And the Mishnah is the commentary on the Old Testament, and it's a part of the first part of the Talmud. And Letter of Gamaliel was written in Aramaic. And the Mishnah is, of course, written in Hebrew. And the, well, so it would be, of course, because not many people know that. And the Gemara is, in fact, written in Aramaic. Okay. Now, Joseph Bar Matthias, he was known by his captive or slave name, Flavius Josephus. William Winston, who translated Joseph's History, the Wars of the Jews, Antiquities of the Jews, Dissertations, Joseph Bar Matthias' autobiography, they all contain Aramaic originals, and Joseph Bar Matthias translated them from Hebrew into Greek personally. He did it himself, just like Sirach Bar Yeshua did his grandfather's work from wisdom from Hebrew. He translated into Greek himself. Now, there were some political developments that took place that would help to expand the use of Aramaic, and that would propel this usage well into our time, which would be the source of great controversy in the biblical world. As Greek would become more dominant, and then you would have the rabbinic Hebrew camp wanting to establish dominance of its own traditional text, and so the Aramaic would actually need this development to represent a certain faction of, well, I would say, nonpartisan record. So, because I don't know if you know, but a translation or whatever, any kind of textual tradition can have a little bit of a commentary within it. Now, let me just look at, we're still continuing with the Aramaic Old Testament here, but this Peshitta, which is the traditional Aramaic text, now it is a Peshitta, a Peshat, means simple. Can also mean literal, and it is a traditional text that was that tradition began in what we call Mesopotamia. We talked about Mesopotamia on the previous podcast. But anyway, we'll just make a few notes here. So the Aramaic Peshitta is important and under recognized witness to the text of the Old Testament. And the exact origin of the Peshitta is unknown. So nobody knows exactly some guesstimation exactly who commissioned it, but a lot of details are not known, as how the project was started, who was involved in which school, whether the scribes get their education, whether the scribe Judean brought to Haran or Mesopotamia, or did they go and learn in Jerusalem and come back. So a lot of details about how the Peshitta was composed is shrouded in mystery and legend. But what we do know, and we have a testimony and record to, is that there was a king in Adiabene. And Adiabene is a province in today we call northern Iraq, and it's a very small. But it had become a vassal to the Parthian Empire between the period of 247 BC and 224 AD, nearly 1,000 years. And it's in northern Iraq, and its capital was Arba Ilu. And in the first century A.D., this royal family embraced Judaism. The Queen Mother Helena, famous for her generosity to Judeans and the temple, and her son, Monobazus II and Xerxes II, were buried in the tomb of the kings at Jerusalem. These men were so devout that they were buried in the tomb of the kings in Jerusalem. That's a very important fact to know. Adiabene being was frequently attacked by the Romans during their campaigns against the Parthians. So these people were not friendly to the Italian invaders of that part of Africa, and they fought to maintain the autonomy and liberty of the ancient Judeans as well as their own. Now, Joseph Bar Matthias has he devotes an entire chapter to this family and what they asked him more than the chapter. He devotes a couple few chapters, but anyway, in chapter 20 or book 20 of his Antiquities of the Jehudim, in book 20, chapter 2, he says, about this time it was that Helena, queen of Adiabene, and her son Isaias changed the course of life and embraced the Jewish customs, and on this occasion, following Monobazus, the king of Adiabene, who had also the name Bazius, fell in love with his sister Helena. He took her to be his wife. He begat with her a child, and as he was in, there's a lot of legends, but this is the origin of that particular family, okay? So they had embraced the Judean customs, and this is how this all came about. So he had his sons that he had with his wife and his other wives. He had them sent to Jerusalem to get their education, okay? And so when they got their Judean education, so they were educated in the temple by the ancient Levites. They learned Hebrew, Aramaic, and all this sorts of knowledge. And they eventually converted not only just his home, but the whole royal family became they became proselytes. So by their proselytization into the Hebrew or the Judean faith, you know, they're doing the festival, they're doing Pesach, they're doing the rituals, they're doing the holy days, and they have the next, and of course, the next step is concluded that this family unilaterally established the Peshitta, the Aramaic textual tradition, a complete Aramaic Bible with, you know, of course, no Hebrew. So that's what we're saying. The Aramaic textual tradition began in northern Africa in the city of Adiabene. Okay? Now, from this point, since we know the Peshitta Old Testament exists, from that it was established by this people, is certified by Josephus, Bar Matthias, and other ancient historians. So it is fact. The Peshitta exists as fact. We know it. It is extant. So now we have to learn to just how do we use these documents? How do we use these records? And part of it is by learning to read them, learn the grammar, and learn the significance that it is something that we must have people in our community to be able to and make use of these records to share with the rest of the community. Now, one of the interesting features, Dr. James Trim notes is, he says the books of Ezekiel and Proverbs in the Aramaic Peshitta read very similarly to the Aramaic Targums. That means Targum Jonathan and Targum Onkelos, which we just introduced you to earlier. And he says the Peshitta, Tanakh, Old Testament had many Jewish liturgical divisions. For example, the Psalms are divided into five sections, as in the Jewish copies of the Torah is divided, and according to the triennial reading cycle, and festival readings are also indicated. So, what it is, like instead of like the weekly Sidra or the Parashat Torah portions are divided up to be completed in a year, beginning at the conclusion of Sukkot, Shemini Atzeret, with a Torah scroll rewound, and you read it in 1 year. Well, then the Peshitta is divided into in such a way where you read it in 3 years, because they didn't follow that tradition. They started had their own. And he said the Peshitta Torah also contains many headings which are likely of Judean origin. And he goes on, James Scott Trim cites many notes about the details of the Peshitta to Old Testament. Now, what about, are there any other traditions? Yes, there is the Peshitta New Testament and many of the apocryphal writings, like the Book of Enoch, which is considered a pseudo epigraphal. Yes, there are Aramaic and Amharic versions of those texts, and Amharic is a Ethiopian or Cushite Sudanese language that has its own biblical tradition. We will discuss that at another date. We will have a presentation on Amharic and its text and biblical text, and that'll be a very interesting one to do. But anyway, George Howard, many other scholars of the last century have written concerning the Hebrew and Aramaic texts of the New Testament, so-called New Testament. George Howard, the great scholar, he was the one who found a Hebrew Matthew that shed a lot of light on how the Greek copies, traditional Greek texts, were not the originals. And we have some more scholars, there are more scholars that have studied it. Here it says, James Trim has in the introduction of his Hebrew Roots version of the scriptures, and he devoted over 50 pages to detailing the information and catalog and histories and quotes by scholars and what they said, so what they had to say about the New Testament, Old Testament, and Targums and whatnot. One person has said the Peshitta is not a translation, but a revision of the old Syriac version. Syriac is another name for Aramaic. So, since this particular scholar name is not given right here in this note, I guess there must be one that was a church father guy. So, anyway. We have, and one thing, the Peshitta doesn't have 2 Peter, 2 John, and 3 John, Jude, and the Book of Revelation. But they are found in other Aramaic forms. They just weren't canonized in the Peshitta. But different communities accepted them as they were given. And there, Phinehas. It's a traditional Kabur's Codex, which is posted on the archaic Canaanite, Aramaic, Hebrew, and Ge'ez page. We have a link to it where you can go and read the Kabur's Codex. That is a Aramaic text. The Codex Sinaiticus, which is the Aramaic text of the four Gospels. I think we have a copy, at least have a link to that on the Facebook page. But what we don't have online is the Apocalypse, which is Revelation in Syriac posted. Anywhere where you can go and catch the link, we may have to see if we can locate one. If they're not available, you probably have to purchase a hard copy of it. But basically, that's a brief run through of the history of the significance of the language, alphabet, the script. I don't know if we didn't go too deep into the script, but we did, you know, survey that the script is ancient. It's actually the script that you see, that you know as Hebrew, the square script, is actually of Aramaic origin, Mesopotamian, and you know, Hebrew got its characters, a script from the Arameans and the Canaanites, who shared their script. So that's all been, we've covered that, and the books that we'll be using throughout our study will be Eric D. Raymond's Intro, Lessons in Aramaic, and Algier F. John's A Short Grammar of Biblical Aramaic. And we will revisit the different issues as and introduce them. So whenever you download the book on the free e-text that is hyperlinked on this blogtalkradio.com show event, you can download it, print it, and you can do the exercises, and you can use the commentary that and lecture notes to guide you through the learning of biblical Aramaic. And that will be the purpose of this series and of every series that we do regarding biblical languages, to help guide you, to motivate you to continue on, not give you the answers to the exercises, though that may be interesting to you, but you have there are answer keys and to these exercises for you to follow to guide you through that section. But this is just to help, you know, give you some, you know, feedback on this, and hopefully you'll be able to, you know, tune in and post your questions and comments on the event page and or on the show page, or you may even decide to join African Aramean Scriptures group on Facebook and be able to share some of your images and results, news concerning epigraphy, that it, and other translation issues in that group, which is most important to this task of developing, cultivating our own scholarly network. But anyway, we hope you all have a good week, Shavuot Tov, and we thank you for tuning in to African Aramean Scriptures and exploring biblical Aramaic. Have a good night. Ayla told.